It's a combination of checking your ego at the door and really thinking about the song. And if you can get melodic and musical, you know, during the process, as long as you're not stepping on any other instrument's toes, you know, it's good.
Welcome to episode 112 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. All right, what's up, folks? What's up, folks? How y'all doing? What's going on? What's going on? What is going on? What is going on? What's the latest? What's the latest? My interview with Michael Valerio for Bass Magazine will be coming out shortly. If you're not hip to Michael Valerio, at least by name, I will say this. I will say this. Whatever genre of music you play or listen to, 99.99 with like a line over the nines, you know, like pretty much almost 100% sure you have heard Michael Valerio play. You just don't know you've heard Michael Valerio play. He is the principal bassist on most, I don't know about most, on a lot of TV and film scores. He's got roughly 1,200 titles that he's played on. He is a seriously bad dude, and it was an honor to hang and do an interview with him for Bass Magazine, and that should be coming out very shortly. I will let you all know when that's live, and you can stop by Bass Magazine online to check it out. What else is happening? What else is happening? All right. This is happening, right? I was talking about the Fender PJ on the last episode. the Fender Precision and Jazz Bass. PJ was also the name of the guest, coincidentally. But I'm talking about the bass. So I've been taking it out to all my gigs, like trying to get comfortable with it. First thing I noticed right out of the gate, I miss playing a five string. that's what I noticed. The Fender's great. The Fender's great. I have it strung up with some D'Addario flats. Like kind of my rig is that bass with the D'Addario flats. Going through a Trickfish Trilobite preamp. The head I'm using is a GK MB500 through an Epiphone UR112. I think that's enough gear talk for now. Otherwise, I'm really happy with the rig, and I'm really happy with the bass. Really love the bass. Really love the bass. It's just, you know, adjusting to that instrument after playing the five string for so long, which has a completely different neck profile, and everything's different. So, you know, just getting used to this one. I do gotta say this. So I put a pickup cover over the P bass pickups on the bass. I love the look. I love the look. That's why I did it. And that's coming off. That's coming off because it impedes the technique where, you know, the palm mute thing to get that really kind of neo soul R&B flub, you know, that super dead sound where you just kind of palm mute it and play with your index finger and thumb. I can't do it. Like I've tried, like the spacing's all jacked up. Like the pickup cover falls right in the sweet spot of where that technique occurs. So that's coming off. The pickup cover is coming off, and a tortoiseshell pickguard is going on. I made that deal with the bass. Pickup cover off, tortoiseshell on, and then it should be cool. I kind of want to play around with the bridge cover. Like I like the look of the old pickup covers, you know. And so we'll see. Maybe the bridge cover won't impede. And I'm talking about like the P bass bridge cover, not the J bass bridge cover that goes all the way over the bridge pickup. No. Just the bridge. Maybe that won't impede the palm muted sound. So I'm going to check that out. And I'll be hacking away at that this week. If you are in or around Southern California, the Bass Shed Academy is holding the summer bass workshops on Saturday, June 24th at Lemur Music. Marlon Martinez is the instructor for the classical workshop. Marlon was on episode 86 of the Bass Shed podcast. You can go listen to that episode to check him out if you'd like. I will be teaching the jazz workshop and the electric bass workshop. For all information, stop by thebassshedacademy.org. Click on programs, scroll down to summer bass workshops. To everybody that went to the ISB convention in Ann Arbor, Michigan, from everything I've been seeing and hearing, it appears like it was a really great time out there. Hope you're all able to connect with T from Lemur Music. Lemur is celebrating the ISB convention with 15% off all regularly priced merchandise. Head over to lemurmusic.com. Use the promo code ISB23 for 15% off. Again, that is ISB23 for 15% off any item at lemurmusic.com. Everything you need for the double bass. On the podcast is Roberto Valli. Roberto Valli. Now, I met Roberto at the NAMM show, and I don't know if I had met him before or not. Like, I feel like I had, and I was at the NAMM show, like, trying to place it. Like, man, I feel like I know you. Like, where did we meet? And, like, throwing out some clubs and some, you know, whatever, gigs and stuff. Like, no, I don't think that's it. Huh. Like, it's somewhere, but I don't know where. I don't know. Like, the jury's still out on that. I haven't figured it out. But it was great to have him on the podcast. And I'm starting to believe that maybe I have not met him before, and he's just that charismatic of a guy. I'm really thinking that's what it is. Roberto is going to talk about his backstory a little bit. He's also going to talk about songwriting. But I gotta do this. I gotta talk about, like, just some of the names that Roberto has played with. It's incredibly extensive. George Benson, Christopher Cross, Bob James, Al Jarreau, Hilary Duff, Diane Shore, David Benoit, Boz Scaggs, Kirk Whalum, Bobby Caldwell. That was a 29-year run with Bobby Caldwell. We recorded this, actually, not too long after Bobby had passed. So it was nice to hear from, you know, Roberto, who had the gig, about Caldwell. Going on, Patty Austin, Arturo Sandoval, Larry Carlton, Marion Meadows. Like, it's crazy. It's crazy. The dude's just on the scene crushing it. I had a great time hanging with him, and here it is. Here's my talk with bassist and songwriter Roberto Valli. Roberto.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing good, man. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Do I look stellar, or
is this... You look like you're training for a fight.
Come at me, mother... No, I'm good.
Yeah, I like the moxie.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
What are you up to?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm actually, you know, juggling fatherhood and, you know, got my kid off to school. She's my last one, you know, in my litter. That, okay. You know, she's still a minor and taking her to high school. And, well, she takes herself, but I think she's going to let me take her on Thursday.
Okay.
And I got prepared and... I'm going to just, you know, just some domestic stuff that kind of thing. But as far as work goes, you know, just got a big okay from record label for a song that probably Norman Brown is going to do on his next recording project that I wrote.
Nice.
Excellent guitar player.
Sure.
And I, besides being an artist and a bass, I mean, an artist, bassist, whatever, I also have co-written a ton of songs for people like him in the smooth jazz idiom, you know.
Right.
I have, like, probably 80 songs on other people's records.
Wow, that's great. That's killing, man.
Yeah.
Man, so we met at NAMM, but I feel like I've met you before somewhere. I can't remember. I know we talked about that a little bit at NAMM. Like, I feel like our paths have crossed at some point, but I can't remember when or where or how. But needless to say, we're here, and thanks for being a part of this.
Absolutely. Were you ever in a detention center?
Years? I'm not going to say no. What years specifically are you asking about, and what state and or province?
Yeah. No, it would be LA. No, but I'm kidding. I wouldn't anything like that. But you know. In our business and in our profession, you know, maybe you could have seen me or heard the name, or maybe I was playing somewhere or you were playing somewhere. So
sure.
I don't know. We only met at the NAMM show. I take it you're a bassist too.
Yeah, I am.
And like the people who are going to watch this podcast are musos, bassists.
I can't imagine, you know, anybody in finance tuning into this podcast.
Okay.
Yeah. No, but if there is, like, hit me up. I got some finance questions. I got to sort some things out.
I gotcha.
So let's, where are you from originally?
I'm from Brooklyn, New York.
Okay.
And I grew up in the suburbs in Brooklyn and went to high school of music and art back when it was up in Harlem, and they called it the Castle on the Hill. And there was a kid a year or two older than me, Marcus something, Marcus Miller. He was there.
Never heard of him.
Yeah, I had. He was actually playing clarinet in the
Really?
orchestra. Yeah, he was playing clarinet and he played bass guitar in
Sure.
the ensemble.
That's hilarious.
That's when I mean, besides like going to shows and seeing like people like Billy Cobham and Chicago, and I saw like a monster. He was a monster when he was 16, 17. I would lend him my jazz bass, or he would or I would borrow his jazz bass, because he was in senior jazz ensemble, I was in junior, and it was great to see him. And there were a few classical bassists that were there. They were older than me, that mentored me, that got me in with some teacher professors on the double bass. And that was a great, really great experience to go to that high school. They made the movie Fame with that about that school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
And
interesting.
actually, I saw that. I saw the film. They were interviewing seniors when I was a senior there. And they called that project Fame, at the time was called Hot Lunch. And I remember being talked to, being interviewed by scouts, and I guess they were looking for extras the film, besides the main characters, around the school. What better extras than students that actually went there? So when I went to see the movie a year later with a girl much older than me, we shared the same birthday. We actually went on our birthday. I
Oh,
think I
cool.
was 19 and she was 22.
Okay.
I didn't want to say, "Oh God, I see Melanie. Oh, I see Steven."
You want to shout out to all your friends?
That was a great experience, just to be in that atmosphere of musicians and artists, and the level of proficiency. And to be the smaller fish in the bigger pond was actually a good thing, because it showed me kind of where I needed to go.
Yeah, that's great. So then after high school, would you did you go to college to consider formally studying music? Did you just get into
No,
the
I was going to Juilliard during high school in the preparatory division, and my private teacher taught double bass at the Juilliard school. His name was Homer Mensch. And during high school, all I knew is that I loved to play. I was in bands that actually made money in high school, and even in junior high school, I was doing little bar mitzvah jobs with my band, Sweet 16 parties. The drummer's father in the group, he had a club date office, and so he would give us all this work. He'd pay us peanuts. He'd take a big chunk, $40, $50, which is not really much, less than what I make now.
I was gonna say rates haven't changed.
That much, but it was great, because we would rehearse, and we got a repertoire together, and we would play, and we would set up, and we'd be on time and learn the music. And we were doing like kind of the top 40 at the time: Chicago, Santana, Bachman Turner Overdrive, Wings stuff, and just little things there. And then in school, it was all classical and jazz, And after high school, I thought I would take a year off. I wound up getting a job with a show band, and we were traveling the country. I was 18 and traveled around. I wound up we After about a year touring with them, we wound up in Key West, Florida for 2 weeks. And on my only night off, I went out with a new friend that I met in town and heard jazz, and wound up sitting in at this jazz club. And next thing I know, they asked me to be their house bassist. Well, do I want to play disco music, or do I want to play jazz with people a lot older than me and really get schooled? So I opted for that. And time in Key West, met so many musicians there. I then joined a band in Alabama that was so ahead of its time for me, I thought, because we were mixing up jazz and R&B and funk and doing original music. The name of the band was called Forecast. And then after the band, they changed the name to The Cast. Mm-hmm. And it was like Red Hot Chili Peppers with a girl playing flute, singing up front. So it was really, it was a cool band, just a power quartet. And I amicably left them to go play in Europe and live in Europe. And I thought that would be the gateway for me to go to Italy, where my family's from.
Sure.
I spent 4 months in the south of France working. And then I traveled around Europe, mainly from France to Switzerland, Italy. And I stayed in Italy for like a month, met my American friends in the fall and then we went to the Alps and we played a winter in the Alps. And I did that for 3 years.
That's amazing.
And it would be Key West in the fall, the Alps in the winter, Key West in the spring, summers in Biarritz, surfing and playing music every night.
Man.
And wound up.
And you're like 18, 19 around this time?
I was already into in my 24th year is when I went to Europe, you know, and did that. And I made friends with Jeremy Wall, who was an associate producer for the group Spyro Gyra. Mm-hmm. I met West and he liked the way I played. And I guess there was one time when I was going to be down there and he wanted to take a vacation and maybe do some gigs because he played keyboards. And like Jeremy Wall from Spyro Gyra. And he just hired, you know, this pickup band, you know, to play with him. And we became friends. And I had heard that from a luthier, a bass repairman who I knew in New York, that Kim Stone was getting ready to leave Spyro Gyra. And I thought, yeah, you know, I could probably play with them. You know, let me contact Jeremy. So Jeremy got me the audition to audition for them. So I flew up from Florida and wound up being in a cattle call of bass players. And make a long story short, I got the job.
Yeah.
And so and I immediately went to move to Manhattan, started rehearsing with the guys, and we were actually able to, on that Stories Without Words tour and that album, we rehearsed the songs, brand new songs, actually played the songs live, and then went into the studio to record them. And that was a first for them, because they would go in the studio first, record things, and then go out and do the tour. That's usually how it goes. But we were able to like test drive the songs, and there's videos on YouTube of me with them when I was a kid on the Neil Hall show and the Tonight Show, and you know, with hair, you know, with those guys. So that was the start of my, you know, I guess, professional career with a name band.
Mm-hmm. And then how long had you been with Spyro?
I was there with them, touring with them for almost 2 years, and did one album with them. And I wound up getting an offer to play with a singer-songwriter, Michael Franks.
Okay.
And I joined Michael's band back when, you know, you played a tour for a year. We did like 130 shows, you know.
Okay. And
Michael's shows in California, I had become aware that my hero, Bobby Caldwell, was back on the scene as Bobby Caldwell, not writing for like Boz Scaggs and Janet Jackson and Al Jarreau and all the people that he were writing songs when he was kind of on hiatus as an artist. So I actually invited Bobby to come hear me play with Michael. And as fate would have it, Bobby came to hear me and came up to me after the show and just said, "Roberto, shake my hand. I love you. Love the way you play. Love how you sing. I know that your tour is ending in December. I start rehearsing in LA in February. And I'd love for you to be my bassist because Jimmy Haslip, he's got obligations. I used him for my last tour. But he's going to be playing with his band, the Yellow Jackets. Will you be my bass player?" And that's when I decided to move to LA. And that was over a little over 30 years ago.
Okay.
And I continued being Bobby's bassist off and on until the last show that we did in January 2020.
Yeah.
And between Bobby's sickness and COVID, that would be that was the last show that with Bobby. The last show that he did.
Yeah. And we lost him recently, and I apologize that I don't remember the month, but it was, yeah, I remember it was very recently.
I don't remember the day. Yeah. It was, I think it was in February. Yeah. Okay. It was past right around Valentine's Day, which was the last time that we played together, which was when What You Won't Do for Love was released on a heart.
Oh, wow.
On a heart-shaped, you know, LP, yeah, back in 78.
Wow, that's interesting kind of bookend, you know, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, man.
Wow. So the whole time you're touring and working with Bobby, what are you doing on the side when he's not on the road, or if he's not working? What are the other things you're getting into?
I was getting into songwriting with the guy that was playing sax in the band. His name was Jim Oppenheim, and he wound up becoming extremely successful. First of all, he had to change his name, which I thought was kind of dumb, but it worked out really good for him. He became Boney James, and
okay,
like second to Dave Koz, notoriety and popularity in smooth jazz. And I was with him in the early days. Writing some songs on the record. And Paul Brown, who mixed front of house for Bobby first tour in Japan, he produced Boney's first records.
Okay.
That was the opportunity for me to go and step up to the plate and start recording for Paul Brown, who eventually became like the baby face of smooth jazz production and became an artist himself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to say that he's put me on hundreds of songs, you know, since then. I kind of had to work my way up the ladder, but he was using the likes of like Alex Al, who's amazing. You know, you hear Alex and it's like, you know, Alex within 10 notes, like, oh yeah. And not many people. You could hear that, and you can say that about them. He was using Freddie Washington a lot also. So Larry Kempel, monster players. But I guess Paul, as he said to me, he really likes my instincts, how I approach the song and how musical he says I am. And he sees that I'm like can go multi-genre. And also multi-bass, like if it's something needs fretless. I remember the first time he called me to play, I think it was before his first album, I played acoustic bass on a couple of Bob James songs that he was producing. And he's like, "Man, you know, you don't just play the acoustic bass, Roberto, you really play, you know?"
Yeah.
So, and Bobby, you know, said the same thing when we started doing his big band stuff, you know, and, you know, people are happily surprised, you know, because a lot of great electric players don't have the strength or the chops to play upright. And then a lot of great upright players who can play the classical stuff and the legit stuff all day long, they just have zero groove, zero feel on the electric bass.
Yeah. I mean, at NAMM, we met at the Wilfer booth. You know, we met at the Upright booth, and then in preparation for this, you know, like I'm reading up on you and doing some stuff, and like, oh man, he's deep in the smooth jazz game. That's fascinating to me because I don't ever think, you know, when I think of smooth jazz, I don't ever think that they double on upright also. You know, I think like smooth jazz guys are just deep into that thing. And that's so that's worked out as a positive for you, being able to you got kind of note recognized by both within the world, both meaning electric and upright, which is there's not a big space for upright in that music.
No. And for, you know, for good reason, I always say, because people ask me, they want to know, they send me a song, well, what do you think? Fretless, fretted, you know, and sometimes, you know, you have to have the wisdom and the discernment, you know. Why don't you like the synth? I'm hearing your synth bass. What's wrong with it? You know, I don't know. I don't know if I could, you know, I could, I don't know if I could beat that. I could, it'll be different. I try to play it like a synth, which I can do. But I just kind of let the song tell me, you know, what it needs, because I
Of
think
course.
it's already out there in the cosmos. You just have to have the sensibilities to think, you know, what's going to work. At the end of the day, really anything could work. I've done hip hop sessions on the double bass. I'm trying to remember, there was one earlier hip hop thing, and I didn't know, but do I think it was Ron Carter. I was on the Ron Carter
Yeah,
documentary.
the
The
Tribe
dude.
Called Quest, was that the what he did? Ron played with Tribe Called Quest, right? Or Neo? I forgot the records he did.
This was like 30, 40 years, you know, this is a long time ago. He thing like on tents, like doo be da doo boo be da doo dee, and they just sampled that and made a song out of it. One of George Benson's biggest radio hits was a cover that I played upright on, Softly as the Morning Sunrise, you know. And really cool version, like the drums were, and it was all MIDI drums from the the Akai MPC, you know. So dun, don't ba boo da doom bing doom 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 doom. So sometimes, you know, the electronic drums and the organic acoustic bass, you know, works really cool, you know, together. So he had a mega hit with that song, and I played another song on that album called Arizona Sunrise. I played on the electric bass. So that's my
Speaking of
accolades.
that, he lives out in Arizona. Do you go out there to work with him?
You know, I've done some shows in Arizona. I think the last time I saw George in Arizona, I was playing with some other guitarists. And I peeked into George's dressing room, and I said, "Hey, George, Mr. Benson, I'm Roberto Valli. I played on Softly as the Morning Sunrise." And he got up, shook my hand, and we became, you know, we became friends. I didn't meet him through in the recording process, but I was playing with Paul and Marc Antoine, and I think Kenny Rankin. It was three guitarists, and Kenny also sung, you know, sung like a bird. So yeah.
You mentioned earlier that producers had referenced your approach to the music. If you could kind of encapsulate what your approach is or where you go when you're coming into a session or a tune, like, well, how would you describe this approach or what you listen to first or kind of where you start your process?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I guess, you know, listening to listening to the track, you know, listening to what the kick drum is doing, if they have any sort of bass idea that they've already have on the track, you know, and kind of see where they're at with it, you know, what do you like about what's happening, what don't you like, and you know, just it's the kind of thing where you really can't. I think you have to either be born with it, you can develop it, but I don't think that they don't. I can't stress that enough when I talk to kids, when I do like master classes or whatever, just like sensibilities, you know, and using your instincts 101, instincts, you know, where you have to use your discernment. And like, I'm fortunate that, you know, I'm at a ripe old age now, and I've done lots of sessions, and I just kind of go into, I call it my bag of musical pasts, you know, and then I just kind of pick from there, and I just pretty much let the song tell me what I should play. And of course, the person who's signing the check, if they have certain ideas of what they are hearing or what they would like, and it's I like to be molded, and I like to be able to transcribe things that I hear that somebody already did, like, oh, I never would have thought of that, you know. And I learn it, and then I incorporate that into what I'm going to put on the song. So yeah, it's a combination of checking your ego at the door and really thinking about the song. And you know, and if you can get melodic and musical, you know, during the process, as long as you're not stepping on any other instrument's toes, you know, it's good. And that's why people like Anthony Jackson or James Jamerson, and Francis Prestia from Tower
Rocco, yeah.
could play so busy. Each one of them had their own way of playing musically and busy. Paul McCartney also had their, they all had, these are, you know, like four different stars in a constellation of how playful you can be in the song, and it, you're still not upsetting anything, you know, making it bubble. So that's
When I completely agree with you that discernment is such a it's not talked about enough, you know, when it comes to being a musician. And now I think it goes across the board in any instrument, but as a bass player, because we're kind of sitting in the middle between whatever's happening in the percussion area of the stage and then the harmonic area of the stage, and we're right in the middle. We have to discern how we're going to navigate both of those things. But I also think that this isn't a but, it's a continuation. The discernment for me is informed by people you mentioned, by having an understanding of Jamerson or McCartney or Anthony Jackson, or it's like I'm getting their ideas. So like I can, okay, like I'm gonna kind of pull from my Jamerson bag of tricks, or you know, my Pino Palladino bag of tricks, and then like that'll come out. Who are some of the guys that have heavily influenced you? I mean, you came up with Marcus, so I'm sure you've been maybe paying attention to his career, as both of your careers developed. Who are some guys that within the smooth jazz world were informing you to, I don't know what the right word is, hone, mature isn't right the right word, but kind of develop this discernment? And where do you go for, where you come from?
I don't really know of like smooth jazz bassists per se that I really latched on to, besides, you know, really like, you know, digging when I hear a song with Alex Al on it and his the muty way of playing. You know, I it was just more a big culmination of things, like of a much wider variety, not smooth jazz. Just my classical training, I think, has a big had a big impact on how I approach a song as a bassist. And growing up in New York City and being exposed to a lot of the Afro-Cuban music, like the pianist Eddie Palmieri, and how his player played the tumbao, played the baby bass. You know, there's that. You know, Brazilian music, the bossa nova, the samba music, the hybrid of Brazilian dance, and boleros and from Argentina and France, and just a whole lot of things I think make me the bassist that I am, today. And of course, the masterful giants in the where I kind of dove in was like in the cool era of in the 50s, like bassists like Paul Chambers and Jimmy Garrison and Charles Mingus and those guys. And just in the past 20 years, well, of course, Eddie Gomez
Well, I mean, around that period, there's so many great dudes. Percy Heath, Sam Jones.
the one guy that just blows me away, and I could see how he was probably the Jocko at the time without the insanity. Unfortunately, he died way too young in the car accident. Scotty Lafaro
Of course.
was, not only was he an, the unprecedented bass soloist, played with the Bill Evans Trio, how he, he was the perfect guy for that,
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
he laid the cornerstone in that, where the bass was not only accompanying Bill, but they were doing a dance by themselves with the drums, and he was able to get away with it. And I have his book. I think his book that his sister wrote, and many people chimed in. And he got a lot of bass players fired because they were like trying to do that stuff that he was doing. And the leaders were going, "No, man, you need to play effing time, dude."
Yeah.
Trio, but what I really loved about him too was he swung his ass off.
Man,
He really did, man.
I've talked about it on this podcast before. One of my favorite records with LaFaro is a quintet record with Cal Jader where he's just walking. Like it's just a straight up quintet. And it's great to hear him in more of a classic, playing the normal role. Yeah. Not doing the impressionistic piano trio thing. It's that's one of my favorite records with him because it's so outside of how you think about Scott LaFaro, but he's crushing it.
We'll be back right after this.
Hey folks, it is time for you to get featured on the Bass Shed podcast. I'm honored that the podcast is listened to in over 80 countries and is rated in the top 10% of all podcasts globally. If you are interested in supporting the show and getting a shout out about your album, your social media links, or you have some dates you'd like to advertise, head to thebassshed.com, click on community, scroll down, and click on get featured. Get heard by the global bass community and get featured on upcoming episodes of the Bass Shed podcast.
Excellent, sir.
You were at NAMM with Colstein. What's your relationship with Colstein?
Well, I reached out to Barry, oh gosh, maybe a quarter century ago. I saw like a bass or a bow that I liked. And, he was pretty standoffish at the time, as most New Yorkers are. They're brutally frank. And into a mentor, older brother.
Oh, wow.
I adore Barry. And I'm still on good terms with the Colstein shop, although Barry sold the business to Manny Alvarez. And Barry just stayed on. And he's saying that he's having the best years of his life, now semi-retired, just building instruments.
Yeah.
I just got the badge, from Colstein. I'd like to think that I'm a West Coast representative, if you will. And Barry's just making these killer copies of basses that have been through his shop that he had a part at one time to another. And he's building them, and they don't stay very long. They're bought up immediately.
Oh, yeah.
I'm actually, toying with the idea of him building me. He has a bass that's, Yes, over $250,000, a Granchino that he's going to build a copy of. It's that okay. Granchino, if anybody wants to get it over there at Colstein's Manhattan.
Yeah.
But he makes a copy for, you know, a tenth of the price.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's really, really nice, you know, true to form. So, yeah, I'm friends with a lot of the luthiers around the country, the Miami Strings, Island Shop in Greensboro, North Carolina, Robertson's in Arizona and New Mexico, and of course my good friend Andy Stetson at Cincinnati Bass Cellar. You know, these are all, of course, Los Angeles Bass Works, Lisa Gass.
Sure, she's the best. She's done amazing work on my bass. Yeah.
And my, you know, you probably know my favorite guy in Orange County, Jason Brown.
Sure.
Does an amazing, you know, he really spoiled me. I can't really, it's hard for me to play any bass that he hasn't, you know, reworked, you know.
Yeah, he's great. Speaking of Colstein, they have one down at Lemur, and like every time I'm down there hanging, I always have to just spend some time on that bass, like that Colstein down there. Yeah. And I still, every time I talk to her, I'm like, yo, don't sell my Colstein. Don't sell my Colstein. She'll message me like, yo, someone's coming in. They might buy your Colstein. I'm like, no, hold that bass for me. Eventually I'm going to buy it. That
Colstein
makes amazing, amazing basses. Yeah. What are you doing playing wise on the upright right now?
Oh, playing wise. Well, besides sessions I'm doing for clients in my studio, I pretty much play that, with David Benoit, when I'm able to bring my electric and my upright. That's what I love about that my friendship with David. I wrote, besides the fact that I wrote two songs on his last album, co-wrote, and the first song, his first single on that album was the title track of the album and a song that I wrote. But you know, David, besides being one of the nicest guys I've ever worked for, easygoing, you know, plays his ass off. I get to, you know, we part of the show. I'm playing R&B, you know.
Yeah.
Produced by Jeff Lorber and Russ Freeman and that. And then we're playing, you know, Waiting for Spring and like really pretty, you know, straight ahead jazz things. So I get to wear two or three hats with, you know, with David, who play a nice samba. And one instrument that I play, and I'm, if I could ever find anything that comes close to it, I would want to buy it in a second. Is electric upright that I have by Martin Clevenger many years ago.
Okay. And
resurrected it because physically, functioning wise, it's the best thing that I've had. It's just I've had to go through several sort different pickups and preamps for it because I've just worn the thing out, you know.
Yeah.
I have the model, it's called a Bennett, and I've been talking with the people at NS Designs. They make a pretty cool electric upright, because with something like that I can do the R&B thing. I can do a straight ahead thing, and I mean, I can do that on a Fender bass. But
yeah.
It's nice to have it. But just if I'm doing one show, I bring my Clevenger, and I'm good to go.
Yeah, I had a Steinberg electric upright. Those ones always felt interesting to me because you can put it on the tripod, or then you can put it on this end pin kind of extension. And the end pin extension has this weird spacing thing that goes around your waist, you know, so it's supposed to be the same distance as if you're leaning the upper bout against your sternum. Those ones never felt as comfortable to me as some of the other ones. Mm-hmm. The neck was cool, and I think they come with like D'Addario electric upright strings, and so I put legit upright strings on it. The pickup was cool, but there's something about just the feel of the bass and the spacing of holding it didn't feel that's my personal take on those. I've always been interested, and I kind of you know, keep my finger on the pulse a little bit of what's happening in the electric upright world, because portability is huge, you know, or, you know, taking it to like even a small restaurant gig where you don't want your actual upright to be, you know, dinged up or space issues. But that's been mine. Thing with them, but other than that, I liked the NDS.
Yeah, if they would build me one from scratch,
yeah,
you know, I'm not going to do that.
I'd buy your model.
Their necks feel comfortable.
Yeah.
But I like to feel where that D neck is. They apparently do. Have something to offer where you can tape it on, you stick it on like with self-sticking tape where you can have a little thing there.
Okay.
I don't know really what it looks like, but I wish that it had some sort of an indicator where that D neck is.
Right, where the joint would be.
Because, you know, you're going all the way, down to the bottom and how the fingerboard melts into the body, you know, that's a little bit weird. You know, that's a little bit, I wish they left a little bit more room of fingerboard where I'm not like feeling the body where the fingerboard is.
Right. Right.
That doesn't feel natural as an upright player that's played, you know, uprights for decades,
sure.
You know, I mean, I can get the job done. Anyway, it's, you know, they're one out there. I'm actually, you know, I know Eminence makes a decent one, and I know that Azola makes some. You know, if I found the right, you know, bug base, you know, but you know he's not making them anymore, so you have to try to find it. And
I think it was Eminence. I'm gonna actually look it up right now.
Eminence.
Yeah, Eminence. I think it was an Eminence bass. When I heard Mark Johnson, at the Jazz Bakery years ago with John Abercrombie, he was playing one of those. And I haven't tracked one down in LA yet, but they always seem interesting. And like watching Mark Johnson, who's one of my favorite bass players, play one is like, okay, I want to give this one a second look. But I've never tracked one down in LA yet to check out. But they seem cool.
Mark and his wife Ileana Elias. Yeah. We were at Christmas show in Yoshi's in Oakland in December.
And you just did one, or you're going to do one?
Well, we're going to do one, and we did one.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Great.
Yeah, we're going up to Yoshi's in July for two nights.
Okay.
This was the Christmas show, and I don't know if they were in town because they live there, or they were in town because they were doing a gig, but they both showed up backstage after the show. Yeah, so I got to, you know, rub my skin on Mark Johnson. Of his little mojo.
Yeah, that goes all the way back to Bill Evans and Scott LaFaro. And it's,
I actually saw him with Bill.
Mm.
Saw him twice with Bill. And the first time I saw Bill, Eddie Gomez was playing bass.
Oof. That's with amazing. Bill
Jones on the drums.
Oh, my gosh. Was this in New York?
Yeah, I was like, you know, 17, you know, just hanging out in at the Village Vanguard, you know.
Yeah,
dude, I got the courage to go up to Eddie and ask him if I could take a couple lessons. And
what did he say?
He gave me a couple, you know.
He did. Great.
A little bit with him. It wasn't, you know, it. He probably is a great teacher, but I didn't, you know, it wasn't like he took me under his wing and I studied with him, you know, for years.
Right.
I had that more with the Homer Mensch and Juilliard, where he was, but that was being groomed for the symphony, you know.
Right.
And I do love playing with the bow, and I, even though I don't get a chance to do it too much, if I'm doing a jazz gig, I might whip out my bow and try to do a
thing.
Yeah.
I haven't spent the time to like get that together yet. Like it when it happens and it's done well. But I haven't dedicated enough time to getting that thing together.
I know
the bow solo.
I can do it, you know, as good enough where it'll get me in trouble.
what do you got coming up? What's, actually, no. What I want, before we talk about that, you've written all these songs for other people and had all these tracks. When did you really start to, what point in your career did you start to recognize, like, okay, this is something I want to investigate. Like, I really want to make part of my career instead of just maybe like co-writing and being on one and moving on into something else. At some point, it seems like there was a deliberate decision to be like, yeah, I'm going to pursue this. I really enjoy this process.
Yeah. No, that's a great question. So after having, you know, six top 10 Billboard smooth jazz hit singles, and four of them were number one, you know, and I would go to Japan with various groups, and it was probably, you know, just watching my bandmates and Bobby's band, you know, finish the set, and they would run to the booth and sell their CDs, you know, and they'd walk away, you know, with some extra cake at the end of the tour. That was part of the catalyst. And then I had a lot of people ask me, tell me, Roberto, you should, when are you going to make a record?
Yeah.
And a lot of friends that are well known in the genre saying, dude, like Paul Brown, one of them just said, dude, when are you going to make an album? I'll help you any way that I can.
Oh, wow. That's huge.
I'll do, you know, whatever. And so back in 2013, I teamed up with this fellow by the name of Jeff Crothers, who was another writer in Paul's stable. And I approached him, and I remember kind of doing like a smooth jazz sampler where you can kind of like with different stems, you could kind of make your own song. Mm-hmm. And I sold my soul, and I was playing these bass grooves, you know, that people a groove and like try to make a song with it or manipulate what I did. And there was one song that I when I did it, I said, wow, that's really cool. That's really different. Whenever I do a record, Jeff, I want to make something like that.
Okay.
You know? And that was became the opening track on my first album, Boom Boom Boom. The track was called Jazz Trance.
Okay.
And that was kind of what started me making my own records and trying to identify as an artist, as a bass player, and not wanting to sound like Marcus, not wanting to sound like Wayman Tisdale or Victor Wooten, because I can't shine any of these guys' shoes. Where can I fit my thing in? Where, and make something that I'm really proud of? And so I decided, well, the bass doesn't have to play the melody. Mm-hmm. I am not going to, as soon as it starts to sound like smooth jazz, that I think it sounds like that kind of predictable, typical, whatever, I immediately erased it. Okay. And just started going in a different direction. And I wanted it to be, you know, I really wanted to get self-indulgent with it and dig deep into my own musical tapestry of my world travels that I've played all over the world with different art, you know, the different tastes and smells. And so my first couple of records had a lot of accordion, you know, loved the sound of the accordion, and I loved muted trumpet, and I just loved that, you know, what if, like, oh, you know, what about if I, like, mixed kind of, like, if Bob Marley ever did a song with Miles Davis, what would that have been like?
Yeah.
So my first three albums, especially the first two, Boom, 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 then my second album was called Pure Lines.
Okay.
Like, you know, not lines of cocaine, no.
You beat me to the joke, man. You beat me to the joke.
Oh, bye. And then my third album, called Tranquila, there was probably maybe my most commercial, you know, but my other albums, I really didn't care about radio at all. And I was amazed how much notoriety I got from indie artists, I mean, indie artists, indie DJs that reached out to me. And I asked them, how did you find my stuff?
Yeah.
I don't have a radio promoter. I don't have a press secretary or any of that. Like, where did you find me? Oh, you know, it gets around. You know, I put it out there on all the, you know, Spotify and all that stuff. And I guess because they've seen my name on so many other on albums, they decided they would go ahead and listen to it. And I got really positive feedback out of it. And around the time I released my third album and COVID struck, you know, and I was thinking about releasing, a record label approached me to do a cover of The Chicken, you know, The Chicken that Jaco did. And, sure. And I thought, shoot, I'm going to try to, well, actually I had the idea to do it and I shopped it to a record label, a friend of mine that I play on a lot of his artist records. And I told him the idea and he was like, yeah, that sounds good, Roberto. Why don't we, this was in like September of 2019.
Okay.
I think. Yeah. September, 2019. Yeah. Anyway, he was like less than enthusiastic about it. Like, yeah, we're kind of like, I got my roster for the rest of the year. Why don't we talk about it at the beginning of next year? And I went ahead and, you know, called my friend Tom Schumann from Spirogyra, and we put the track together and I played it to him. I played it for him like three quarters done. And he just wrote me back like, oh, mother of God, Roberto. And he said, we need to put this out immediately. So The Chicken's getting ready to be released. And my album Tranquilla came out already. And a week before The Chicken was going to go out formally to radio, I got a text from a friend in Maryland or somewhere on the East Coast. Hey, man, congratulations. I just heard one of your songs on Watercolors, which is like the holy grail of getting your song on a Sirius XM channel. You're going to get, you know, that gets some nice dividends. Nice.
Mailbox, yeah.
I said, that's impossible. It can't be because my song, The Chicken, is not coming out for another week. He said, no, it's not The Chicken. It's a song called Blue Horizons featuring White. And I will say that that's my biggest accolade, that I actually got on a radio a station like Watercolors without radio promotion.
Man.
Somebody in programming got a hold of of that song. I don't think it hurt that Peter White was featured, but you know, that is that's unheard of, you know, sure. People will sell their soul to get their single put on Watercolors, you know,
okay.
That mine got on all by itself and they still play it like three or four times a week, every week.
That's great. Was it what you thought on the back end? Was it what everybody had talked about with like it really having some dividends on mailbox money? Was it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I wish I would have put out all my songs that I put out. I'm batting 4 for 4 after the, let me see, The Chicken. Yeah, I mean, everything I've released since The Chicken has been added on Watercolors.
Amazing.
You know?
You're in.
That's money that I never got as a composer,
right.
As a publisher, because you have to either be the artist, and I put out my songs. I was artist, but nothing ever really became of it on Watercolors until Blue Horizons came out, Sound Exchange. They are the society that pay the artist royalty, and they also pay the master rights owner.
Okay. So
for you kids who want to, you know, go out and make an album, if you put it out yourself and it gets on a station on Sirius XM and you own the master rights, you will essentially get
both sides. Yeah.
You'll you'll get master rights owner and artist artist royalties. So, yeah, I mean, it's not enough to like send me into retirement, but it's a supplement to my you know, yearly income. And I'm as long as I've had this success, you know, and I cross my fingers every time I release a single.
For sure. But,
they seem to really love me there. And, you know, my last single called Woody's Gap, it came out about a month ago, and it's moved up from 47 to 45 on Billboard.
Okay.
Going slow, but it's slowly going, rising up. But the day that it was released, I got on Watercolors, you know, so okay. That, you know, that's really all that anybody really would care about.
Yeah. You know? Have you since, having so much, you know, advancement with getting on Watercolors and right away, have you since got representation and got a manager? Are you still kind of doing the DIY really. Approach?
No, I mean, I have my my record label that they own the masters, and they give me an advance.
Okay.
So they also pay all radio, promotion and things like that. And and I just pretty much do everything, you know, myself. I I'm forfeiting the master rights money just so I can move on. And
yeah.
You know, I've just on the radio right now, I got David's song. I got a song by Carol Albert called Fire and Water. And her fourth single that's going to be next on her plan of releasing is a song, Sol Empanema, that I wrote with her. A song is doing very well that I wrote for Najee called Bounce. I think top 20 right now.
Okay.
And song I wrote pretty recently for Marion Meadows called On the Uptown.
Nice.
That's very well on radio. So, you know,
have you done some touring with Marion?
No.
A good friend of mine back in Arizona was playing guitar with him for a little while.
We've never played on stage together. We've only met, and he just, you know, told me how much he loved the song, because sometimes you don't really meet these people.
Right.
Because, you know, you're giving it to producers and people like that. But it's a great challenge to like juggle, you know, my house and raising the kids and touring and writing and being an artist, writing for other people. I still like to do that, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't really have visions for me to, you know, I never did to really want to go out and tour. If somebody came up to me and said, hey, I got a festival, I love your music, I'd like for you to do 45 minutes, then I'd go through the time and effort of putting something like that together.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I'd rather just, you know, be focusing on writing more and getting these shows done.
The creative process of it all. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Cool. Now we'll go back to the question I didn't ask before. What do you got coming up? Are you doing Yoshi's again in July?
Yeah, we got Yoshi's in July. But before that, week after next, we're going to do some shows with David Benoit in New Hampshire and in Massachusetts and New York.
Okay.
And I'm happy to go back and play in New York. And as the good Lord fate would have it, that's the last show of the tour. So I'm going to stay in New York and visit dear family and friends.
Oh, wonderful.
For a couple extra, you know, days before I really need to be back, you know, back home. And so I got shows with David. I got, I have a jazz festival that I played last year coming up in the fall, where I'll be playing for like eight different artists in Vallarta. And Brian Bromberg actually hired me.
Okay.
Because
you're in his band.
Actually, he played his band. I did play with Brian, and we actually wrote a few songs together some years back, but he's got bass on his computer. He's not playing, you know, accompanying bass, bass. he runs tracks.
Yeah. But
he doesn't want to work with all these other artists. Not that he doesn't want to, but he'd rather just have, you know, Roberto do it.
Cool.
I have to, share the stage with, you know, with the likes of him. And yeah, I'm happy and thrilled that a fellow with his notoriety and chops and whatever he did, you know, oh yeah, Roberto, he can play.
Sure.
You know.
That's cool. He's definitely got facility.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. That aspect of his playing is pretty astounding.
He truly amazed me. In the fall, just watching him and listening to him, because I really don't. All the things that I liked when I was a teenager, as far as like pyrotechnics and chops and all that, you know, like after Jocko and some of those people, it just kind of left me a little bit cold, you know, mm-hmm. like it just became like robo bass player, you know, and I can't say. You know, I kind of put Brian in that category, especially his electric playing. But just listening to him, and you know, watching him, you know, it's almost like, wow, wait a second, you look like you're a physics professor with his white beard and his white hair. And not only is he just playing the eternity out of his bass, everything that he did was just perfect, and it was soulful and funky and in the pocket. And I just went like, it just renewed my respect for him.
Cool.
You know,
is he back in LA now? Cause like a friend of mine who, actually did some touring with David Benoit, drummer, was living near him in Los Angeles, and I heard that he had left Los Angeles for a little bit, and I don't know if he's back.
Ooh, Brian,
Brian.
Yeah, he's not in LA. He's just an hour and a half.
Okay.
He has horse property with his wife.
Right. That's right. I knew he had left, like, you know, LA proper. I don't know, maybe 5-6 years ago or something. But
yeah.
But I've been kind of seeing his name around a little bit more, so I didn't know if he was back down here. I mean, Oha is not far at all. That's cool, man. Dude, anytime you got new news, you got a new tracks coming out, anything, hit me up. Let's talk about it. Let me know what's going on.
I'm working on a few, you know, ditties right now. I actually sent one to David Benoit's manager, who manages Mindy Hebert, and he may like this song. It's not your typical smooth jazz kind of thing, but getting word about, you know, Norman loving this song. So a lot of good seeds planted, and I'm actually working on my next single. And I got the saxophone player kid Jeff Ryan to play on it, and David Benoit already. I wouldn't say is featured, but he is one of my special guests. Okay. You know, on the song that'll be coming out probably in July, August.
Wonderful, wonderful, man. Send me a copy when it's out. I'd love to check it out and tell the podcast community about it.
Yeah, I hope that your listeners, you know, liked, you know, our little conversation, and hope I gave some insight, and
it was a
pleasure to talk with you,
man. Likewise we'll be in touch, Roberto. Appreciate your time.
Okay, have a great day.
All right. That was my talk with Roberto Valli. I had a great time talking with Roberto, and I think it's hip that he went to the school that the movie Fame was based off of. I loved hearing about that, and I loved hearing about his classical studies and dedication to the double bass, while still having like a lot of recognition within the smooth jazz genre as a player and as a songwriter. It's really, really an impressive, diverse career. I think it's fantastic.
If you are enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it. Leave a rating. And yeah, that's all I got for this one, folks. That's all I got. I will catch you on the next one in a minute.